Denise.
Thank you,
Jay. Thank you.
Thank you, I'm Denise, I'm an addict.
Hi, Denise.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here, great to be clean today. And, I kind of thought when I was asked to do this share that I might be able to just sneak in and not know anyone and sneak out again. And it's not worked out that way. There's a lot of people I know in this room tonight, some of them very dear to me, that have been great friends throughout my recovery. Some of them that I know, well, one person that I know from using, and family members, you know, who I class as family members and or a family member. And that's lovely. You know, it's lovely to come to a meeting and to have that, because I haven't come to meetings in London for a couple of years, probably haven't been to a meeting in London. I got clean in West London, but I've moved out. I'm in a little village in Bedfordshire, and it's very different when you go to a meeting week after week and there's like between 4 to 6 people there, you know, their whole life story forever. And there's great things about that, you know, there's real unity in the area that I'm in, there's real fellowship, a lot of love, but it's very different to London meetings, very different. And you know, when I hear about that many meetings being in London, also very fortunate, you know, to have that availability. And for me, you know, very, very, very young, I knew I was very different. It was like I was very quiet and insular, but I was also attracted to chaos. It was like I used to sit, like, you know, my mum and dad had a house that was kind of okay. I don't want to say, do you know what I mean? They had a nice house, a big house. It's like embarrassing, do you know what I mean? And I used to sit there in the bedroom and I'd look out the window to the council estate over to the right, beyond the hill, and kind of just look at it. And I used to go round and see my friend on the council estate. Nothing wrong with council estates, but, you know, it was just the chaos that was going on, you know, on this particular estate. And I used to kind of want to go there and feel more at home there. It was like weird, you know, here I am. My mum and dad worked really hard and I was really fortunate. You know, I had my own pony and whatever, really fortunate. I wanted to be over there, you know, in the council estate. And that was very young that I had that. And very young I had behaviour that I now know through working through my recovery and through working the steps. You know, I had addict behaviour. I'd steal food. I'd isolate. I had it young. The signs were there. And, you know, and I can remember being taken to the doctors because my mum found me binge eating. She was like, what's wrong with her? You know, and took me to the doctors. And it was, that was when I was about 8. So for me, just for me, I know that, you know, I had this illness very young. And I went through school, etc. Had my friends, didn't get in that much trouble actually. I had had my little pony that I went up to. I used to isolate at the stables, and used to go. It was quite exciting, you know, when I first started smoking around the back of the stables. Everything used to happen at these stables with these few people, and I guess I'm just saying it because I was really fortunate, you know, and I had the best possible, you know, chance. And addiction, you know, isn't just a certain person, you know, it goes across the board. And what I did is when I left school at 16 and I decided that actually, my brother was like right clever. He went to Oxford University and kind of got a load of A's and was really clever, and I was like really not clever. And and I went to my local school and got quite a few fails, as it goes. And I kind of used to watch him doing really well. My brother is so normal. Like, just, you know, if he wants something, he saves up the money until he's got it. Do you know what I mean? He's just like, you know what I mean? Rather than go out and get it and then worry about the money. Well, I don't know whether that's an added thing. I guess it might be. And he was really normal, and I kind of used to, I just didn't get him. Do you know what I mean? I just didn't get how anyone could kind of be that normal. And on my 17th birthday, I waved goodbye to my mother and went, I thought it was a great idea to go and live in Spain, Tenerife, in the bars and clubs. And over there, I was introduced to using, really. You know, before that, I'd been a bit sheltered, really, because of the lifestyle and, you know, where I lived and whatever. And I went over there and I worked a night. I mean, I was drinking loads, but that's what you did, you know, every night. You worked from there from 10 o'clock in the evening till 5 o'clock in the morning, and you got paid and you got all your drinks free. So, of course, I drank because that's what you did, you know. So that was just that. And someone came over to me and they owed me some money and they said, have this instead, open your mouth, and popped a pill in my mouth. And that was it. And I share about this quite a lot because that obsession that kicked in over, you know, this ecstasy pill, it's like I had it and I was like, oh, another one. Do you know what I mean? That wasn't enough. It was like half an hour later, I want another one. I want another one. And then I found some people to go out raving with. And then, you know, the next day I didn't sleep and we had some, you know, LSD and this, that, and rah, 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 and off it went. And it was like instant. It was like, just like a love affair, the obsession and the chasing of it, you know, the chasing of the buzz for me. And about 9 days later I came round, I think, and you know, I'd just been using and hardly sleeping, and I kind of came round, I went, oh, you know, I didn't have the money for the rent for the flat that I was living in, you know, that I'd had money previously, you know what I mean, didn't have the money for that. So then I was like, I'll go out and nick some bits. You know, that was my next idea. So I went out shoplifting for perfumes and stuff like that that I could sell on. And that's how it was for me, and that's how it continued for many years. You know, when I start using drugs, I can't stop. I get obsessed with it, I get compulsed with it. I'm not Denise. Like, I'm Denise now in recovery, but I'm not Denise when I use. I'm a different person, I'm ruthless. And you know, I can remember coming back from the airport and my dad picked me up. And when I got home, you know, my mum now says to me, she said she just looked at me, you know, like a year later after I'd done that for a year in the clubs and whatever, and she just looked at me and she said, you know, talking about it since, she's like, the sparkle had gone. You were gone. It was like you were a different person. It's like we lost the girl that went. And I came back and I just carried on, really. I just carried on using. And I had, do you know what? I had real good years using as well. You know, those beginning however many years, I did a lot of clubbing. I managed to work. I had really good jobs. You know, I did well. I did all right. I did notice that I used every day and that other people didn't. I did notice that, you know, something went in, the fact that, you know, I'd go out on a Friday night and not come back till the Monday morning where I'd have a wash and go to work and then have a line of coke on the toilet to get me going for work, you know what I mean, in workplace. And I noticed that, and progressively it noticed me, you know, and I started losing stuff, you know, where I didn't get promotions. I'm quite ambitious, I didn't get promotions, I didn't. You know, one boss said to me, you haven't got it because basically you like going out more than you like coming to work. You know, he was really quite blunt about it, really. Couldn't have put it clearer. And that was the beginning of the downhill. But such was my denial that I just thought I was having a fantastic time. It was all their fault, you know, because whatever. And really, it's just because drugs weren't as good as they used to be. Obviously, I used to have to take more and more and more, chasing those buzzes that I got at the beginning, but I didn't get after, you know? You know, they're not like they used to be. Remember them ones? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Rah, rah, rah. You know, just a load of nonsense, really. And I kept using. And gradually, for me, the progression was that I couldn't keep using and getting away with it. I'd done, you know, a good few years. And I ended up in that council estate, in a bedsit, you know, with dealers all round me, next door neighbours getting murdered. You know, I ended up in that chaos. And I felt right at home. I felt right at home, to be honest. And when I look back, that's really sad, you know, when I say that now. It's really sad that that's kind of, you know, but that to me is the disease of addiction. You know, wanting me in dangerous places, wanting to kill me, basically, you know. And gradually what happened is I just started getting really, really depressed and really in on myself and not going out clubbing and, you know, I'd lost jobs, etc. And I went into an institution for the first time, a mental health institution. And I went in there because I couldn't cope with living because my using was such that I didn't have money, so then I couldn't pay bills. Do you know what, right? You know, like we all know, getting myself in trouble, doing this, doing that, right, you know, and I couldn't cope with life. And I got to a state where they took me into a mental institution. What a result. I, like, got 3 dinners a day, got as much drugs as I wanted, because I could never sleep at night. You know, I'm feeling rather down today. You know, and to be honest, that's how it was to me. My attraction then became to institutions. And I went in 4 institutions and was under one of them for 2 years. And kind of I can laugh about it and joke about it. When I look back, you know, how sad is that, that I couldn't look after myself enough to live in the community, you know, and that I had to be cared for under section for my own health. Because I was insane, you know. And now when I look back through step work, I can see it. But then, do you know what? I didn't even really know that drugs was the problem. I didn't have that. My denial was so strong, I never really thought, do you know what I mean? I knew I took drugs, but that was okay, wasn't it? You know, and that's how strong my denial was. And, yeah, and I kind of was in these institutions and, you know, I had... when I wasn't in the institution, I was in my bedsit and I'd score off the person next, you know, in the bedsit next to me, and I'd have my social worker come around once a week. That's how it was. Come and check I was alive sometimes, I think. And in this institution, for the last time, on the 4th time, the NHS beds were full, so I got to a private place. And I went in, and they put me in the addiction section. and there was a 12-step counsellor, and he used to say to me, "Why don't you go to an NA meeting?" He was the one who introduced me to NA. You know, he said to me, "Why don't you go to an NA meeting?" And I'd be like, "Why?" And he'd be like, "You know, this is what's happening with your drug use. It's bringing you back in here, and then you're going out, you can't cope, you're coming back in here, going out, you know, you're resting every so often, and that's that. Why don't you go to an NA meeting?" And I'd just be like, you know, I just didn't see it. And finally, you know, sitting in there, chatting to people in the smoking room, in this place. Smoking rooms are great. Loved them. Just talked a load of crap for usually for hours on end. And this girl, she'd been on this program, and she went to NA, and she was coming back in as part of whatever care, you know, I don't know, whatever care it was, and she said, "Why don't you come to a meeting with me? I'll take you out to a meeting." And I looked at her and something in there, it was like she was so different in the period of 6 weeks that I'd seen her, 6 weeks before, 6 weeks at meetings. And it was like I saw it. I saw in her just that NA sparkle. You know, when someone gets clean and that sparkle, you know, for the first 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, whatever, and they're buzzing. And I saw that and I was attracted to it. Spiritually, I was attracted to it. I couldn't make any sense in my head. I knew I took drugs. I knew I ended up in institutions. I knew I couldn't cope with my life. I knew that I blamed everyone, you know what I mean? I knew all that, but there was something that attracted me to this girl. And she said, come to a meeting with me. And I said, yeah, I will. I'll come to a meeting with you. And I went to my first meeting. That was Hampstead on a Tuesday night in that little, I don't know whether it's still there, little kind of like tunnel, isn't it? And I went in there and I was petrified. I was petrified. I was really scared. And because I was starting to realise that the drugs, you know what I mean? It was starting to go in that the drugs might be the problem. And I was petrified. And I went into this meeting. They were all mental. Weren't they? And it was quite a chaotic meeting. And I sat in this meeting and everyone was like, hello, how are you? Who are you? You know, welcome. This, you know, it's quite an intimate, small meeting place. And I sat down and this guy arrived to do the share and he was in a suit. I'm like, what's he doing in a suit? You know, and he was, you know, he started sharing. He was like, I've just come from my job in the city. And I'm like, job in the city, you know. And because by that time, it had been a long time since I'd been able to hold down a job. You know what I mean? And that was kind of out of reach for me. And he sat there and he shared. And I was just like, wow. And I got it. You know, the connection, the therapeutic value, you know, of one addict and another addict. I got it there just in me, in my heart. And I got given, I picked up a white key ring and I haven't used since. And the clarity that I got at that meeting when I heard other addicts, because all I'd ever been around was using addicts. I'd never been around clean addicts. So the connection that I got when I heard clean addicts sharing that they'd been clean for 30 days, that they'd been clean for 10 years. And I was like, what? 10 years? You know, I couldn't believe it because I did a bit of controlled using in my idea, you know, what I thought was controlled using, which didn't include drinking or smoking. You know, I thought I'd done that, but I hadn't. And, you know, and I came out of that meeting and I said, oh, I'd like to come back next week to this girl. She said, there's lots of meetings. Why don't you come to another one with me tomorrow? I was like, yeah, okay. And I did. And it was a candlelit meeting. And I shared for the first time. And I shared underneath. I didn't share I was an addict. And afterwards, someone came up to me and they went, are you an addict? Because you didn't say you were. Maybe you want to have a read. You know, who is an addict? Have a read through this, take it away. They gave me the little white booklet with the stories in, and I went home and I read that, or went back to the unit and read that. And it was like, wow, for me, you know, I didn't have to use. And luckily for me, at the third meeting, I met a girl who gave me her telephone number and said, ring me. And then she said, actually, you probably won't ring me, I'll ring you tomorrow. And, you know, thank God I met her because she gave me, she turned out to be my sponsor for about 3 years. And what she did, and sometimes I think, I don't know whether I miss this or other people do, but I don't always see this, you know, she sat with me before, you know, she said, okay, let's go to this meeting together on the Friday. I'll come and get you. Let's go an hour before and have a coffee before. And she brought a basic text. And she showed me stuff and she talked through that. She gave me time and talked through the programme. Said, right, if you want to stay clean, this is what you've got to do. you know, you've got to get yourself a sponsor, just look round if there's people here that are clean, that, you know, you're attracted to in terms of, you know, spiritually, whatever, just go for it. You know, ask them if they've worked the step, listen to them, just do it, rather than sit there for 6 months working out who's going to be the best one for you, you know, just do it. You can always change. She's told me about the 12 steps and that in order to stay clean, I needed to work 12 steps and I needed to go through them formally with a sponsor, whichever way it be, you know, whether it be discussion, whether it be step working guide, you know, however. And I needed to practice those in my life to stay clean every day. Do you know what? I feel quite emotional thinking about it because that was a gift that she gave me then. She told me, because I didn't understand the readings, she told me about drinking. I hadn't heard that you couldn't drink in the readings, the first three meet. I didn't hear that. Why would you? You know, it's like, you know, part of me obviously still wanted to drink. And she said, this is a programme of complete abstinence. You know, we don't drink. And I'm like, but drink was never a problem. But what do you do when you drink? I pick up. Yeah. So it is a problem. There you go. You pick up, you know, you do it. And I'm like, going, oh, yeah. You know, and I asked her to sponsor me. And, gosh, she was tough. She was a tough cutter. She wouldn't put up with none of my nonsense. I'd be like, phone her up and go this, that and the other, and she'd be like, yeah, that's your disease talking, right? And I'd be like, do you know what I mean? But she was also compassionate and loving, you know, and I worked through the steps with her. I worked through the step working guide. I've done it different ways since. I work through a basic tech study now with my sponsor at the moment, and she took me through the 12 steps through the step working guide, and my step one was incredible. It was incredible. I just did it. I just wrote it. And for me to have it on paper written out that I'd been homeless, you know, I slept rough for 3 weeks. Right, it was only 3 weeks, but it was 3 weeks. And I'd forgotten that until I did my... How can you forget that? You know, but my denial, that's how it was. And for me, you know, step one is about honesty, but it's also about, you know, smashing my denial. And I sat and I went through it, and I it was just incredible. You know, I had a spiritual awakening my first step one, without a doubt. You know, being able to see honestly and clearly, you know, how I'd behaved and how I'd used. And I went through the steps of her, and you know, it was great. And one of her suggestions was not to get into a relationship, to do my steps first. I know that's a real debatable one, you know. Now, you know, I've never suggested that to anyone since. Do what you want. But for me, I did that. And then at a year clean, I met someone and got pregnant. Because it was all right to do that at a year clean. So obviously, staying abstinent for a relationship for that period of time didn't do a lot, you know. And I always say about that, because it's like, that's all very well if it gave me some idea how to have a relationship, but it certainly didn't, that abstinence. My daughter's incredible. You know, I had my daughter. I stayed with my daughter's dad for 5 years, where we moved out, you know, etc., into Bedfordshire, and you know, and lived recovery. And all the time through my recovery, I've done meetings. All the time. You know, after I gave birth, that was it. When can I go to a meeting? You know, I went to a meeting within a week. Like, I was in hospital for about 10 days, and then I came out and, you know, I arranged it and I got to a meeting. When traumatic stuff's happened, you know, when I split up with the father of my child, I went to meetings. I went to meetings out of area, because I hate all that nonsense chatting business in meetings. You know what I mean? I went out of area. And I can remember that. It was really painful, actually, my relationship breakup. I'm not going to share in detail about it, because I think that went around the NA news for quite a while. And, you know, it was really difficult. And my higher power, it was like I was in Bedfordshire, My mate of 10 years had relapsed with her husband, and someone who I was sponsoring, I wasn't sponsoring anymore. And I was kind of, I felt really alone. And I was doing service on Parents and Carers Committee, and the chair position came up. And first of all, I thought, oh, God, region, 2 days every other, whatever, this, that and the other, I can't do that, I'm a single parent, this, that and the other. And then, do you know what, I prayed on it and I sat with my higher power and I thought, do you know what, I can do this. I'm in a position where I've been with someone in an area, you know, for 5 years. I've split up. It was perfect timing. Mm-hmm. You know, I love sharing about service. I'm passionate about service. Mm-hmm. I went to region, I went to conventions. I met loads of women. I have got so many numbers in my phone of women from Glasgow to Bournemouth to, you know, just different areas that support me and help me and love me, as I do them back, you know. And service, like, you know, like you were sharing, my first commitment was a greeters. That was great. This meeting, Southgate, Saturday night. And every week I went and greeted in the rain, in the snow, then when it got hot, I was like, hello, you know, outside in my duvet thing. But you know what? I got to know loads of people, got loads of numbers on my phone. We'd start going out after the meeting for dinner off, you know, and I started building where I'd got rid of all my old friends from before. I started building this this network of fellowship. And I do want to share. I want to share about my sponsor. My sponsor is in America. I've been sponsored by her for about 3 years, and maybe slightly less. And my sponsor's incredible. I just think I'm so lucky to have her as a sponsor. She's kind, she's compassionate, she never tells me what to do. She shares her experience. She loves reading, so she's got a lot of knowledge and experience on the literature. She talks about spiritual principles. She works the steps, she does service. I see her active in recovery. I started working the steps with her. Obviously, she's in America, I'm in England. So she emailed it over. It's funny, actually, because she's more available than any sponsors I've had in England. It's really weird. It's like, because she doesn't work, I can phone her at any time from 10, and she gets up really early in the morning. I can phone her from like 10 o'clock in the morning onwards, and that's it, sorted. You know, we can Skype, we can video call. There's loads of different ways. And for me, being in the country, you know, not being accessible to be able to do a meeting a day, you know, having to travel. My home group is 37 miles from where I live, you know, and I'll go there and then come back, and that's 70 whatever miles it is, you know. Sometimes I have to do online meetings, sometimes I have to phone America and do Skype meetings or phone in, you know. I have to use recovery in whatever way I can out there, you know. It's like, you know, it's not in isolation, but there's not many meetings where I am, or they're spread over a big area. And my sponsor, my step one, we went through and she said, are there any reservations? I went, yeah, there is, yeah. And she was like, what are they? And I was like, my daughter dying, a parent dying, or a friend dying. You know, like bereavement stuff. I'd had lots of friends die using, loads and loads more. I know now I'm clean and I look back, but... And she said, that's all right, you can have reservations, it's what you do with them. You know, you can't continue to have reservations. When you get them, be honest, share about them, talk about them, ask other people how they coped. Ask them when someone died, how they coped with it, what they did. You know, get the faith that actually you can do this as well as others. And for me, you know, my higher power again, perfect timing. About 2 months later, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. I can remember 31st March, and I had the sinking feeling, because obviously I've been watching him losing weight, and I had that, oh, is it, isn't it? And they confirmed that it was cancer, and my whole world was taken for, you know, I loved my dad, just still, you know, loved him, and And I got on the phone to my sponsor and I said to her, oh my God, you know, my worst nightmare, my dad is dying. This is horrific, how am I going to cope? She went, this ain't about you. She said, this is about your father. What better way can you make amends? What better way can you make amends to your father right now? This isn't about you, this is his time. And I remember going, you know what, she's right. She said, think about how your dad would want you. You know him, you know, you've known him 37, 38 years. You've known him that long. You know how he reacts. How does he want you? And I thought about it. I thought, it's really practical. He doesn't like all this, you know, holding hands business. Don't do any of that. Sitting there going, oh, you're right, you know. And I did it. And we sat with him. We were told he'd live. We were told he could have treatment, you know. Didn't happen. And I sat with him up the hospital, reading, and I say this, you know, he couldn't talk the last 2 weeks of his life. He was in hospital, he'd had a couple of strokes, and he couldn't talk. It was horrific. He was just fading away. And he said he'd get us to read off, because he was really nutritious, like he liked all nutritious foods. So he'd get us, you know, they're fed through the nose. We'd have to read, we'd sit there and go, right, there's 1% of this. 2% of that, and go through it, because you know what, that's what my dad wanted. He didn't want me wailing all over him, you know, and I was fortunate enough. I was so scared of him dying, so scared, and I prayed, you know, for the courage, and I was fortunate enough to be holding his hand when he did die. And I say I was fortunate enough because he was, it was really peaceful. And, you know, to me, that's my biggest amends, you know, that I could possibly make to my father. I was at peace with him. I'd worked through my steps. I'd worked through my amends. But just, you know, and I'm really thankful for this fellowship, to this fellowship, to be able to give that to me, to do that. And to have the people that I could phone and that I couldn't phone. Some of my friends, I had to phone up and say, do you know what, I can't talk to you at the minute. I just haven't got enough time or whatever. And then I'd have another friend who was a nurse, and I'd phone her up every day going, what does his blood pressure mean when it's going down? The nurses aren't telling, you know, and she'd talk through it with me. I noticed the medication cupboard quite briefly, and the fact they left it unlocked a lot. You know, I'm an addict. It's what I do. I noticed these things. I shared about it, and I kept safe, and I was held through the fellowship. And my dad died on the Sunday. And, you know, the next weekend I went to a convention, because that's, to me, what being in recovery is about. No matter what, we go to meetings, we do service, we sponsor people, we're sponsored, you know, and we do what's asked of us. And then, you know, I find that incredible that this addict who couldn't live outside of an institution could do that for her father, you know, and he's with me all the way. Always, I can feel him, you know. I know when I'm in a pickle, I'll pray and I know what my dad would say, you know. And I take gratitude from that. It's really good to be clean. I'm really grateful for my life today. I met up with someone today here at this meeting who I haven't seen for a lot of years, and we've used together, and this person's now in recovery as well. And we were talking about work, and I was like, I've got a right good job, mate. I've had such a touch. Do you know what? It's like, the reason I say this is, you know, when I was sharing earlier about, you know, I was quite ambitious and quite good, and it's kind of like, you know, in terms of job ambition. And recovery stole that. I mean, addiction stole that away from me, and recovery's given it back. I've worked really hard, and I'm now in this job, and I do 27 hours a week, which means I can pick my daughter up from school, take her to school most days. I get paid enough to have a mortgage and to do bits and pieces that I want to do. And I work alongside the social worker that used to come to my house once a week. And she's now a manager, and so am I. and we work along, and I can remember seeing her, and we hadn't seen each other for a long time, and I walked in, and I was like, all right. She was like, all right. and she said, and one of my members of staff, because I manage these people, I love, like, this is just ego, isn't it? I manage these people. One of our members of staff was like, oh, do you know each other? She went, yeah. She went, yeah, we go back years. You know, and that to me, I kind of share about that, because that's kind of like, and there's a twinkle in her eye, because she's glad I've got clean as well. You know, she's glad. And then, you know, if there are any newcomers here today and you do want to know more about the programme, please, you know, go to the newcomer reps or ask someone after, or ask for numbers, and you know, and ask for people to take some time to explain the programme to you, you know, as that person did to me, after, you know, at my third meeting. And thank you for letting me share.